Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Available seasonally at select Whole Foods markets. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. It was nice to see you in three dimensions the other night, dude.
Right. In-person hangout, you and I, at a cute little bar over in Bushwick.
So weird. So weird.
Yeah. I think it's really kind of tragic that you and I live in the same city and we see each other so infrequently, other than, you know, once a week via screens on the Speakeasy.
Well, I also think part of the problem is that you live in North Brooklyn and I live in South Brooklyn, and public transportation in this borough is such that it will often take less time to drive from my apartment to Philadelphia than to get to where you live on public transportation.
Yeah, I mean, Brooklyn, if it broke away from New York, Brooklyn would be the second largest city in America.
What would be the first? L.A.?
Yeah, L.A.
Okay. Well, we can't let them have that.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's some distance between us, but it's still a crime that we don't get to hang out very much. So thank God we got to see each other at All Night Skate, pretty cool little bar. Got to have some drinks and catch up, long overdue.
Yeah, I hadn't been there in, I think, probably 5 years. But like we said on a previous show, it made the James Beard long list. So I was, you know, not I was it was a bit of a surprising inclusion, I think, not necessarily because the quality isn't good, because the quality there is fantastic. I love that little bar. It was just kind of I don't know, the overlap of people who do James Beard Awards and the people who are sort of the target audience of this kind of like very funky 90s nostalgia themed bars. I don't know. I didn't think the little middle section of the Venn diagram was that big, but apparently I was wrong. What do I know, man? I just work here. Right. It was fun to catch up in person, especially after this past weekend. I competed against a non-human being for a cocktail competition. And,
that's right. You fought the robots.
I did. I fought the robots. And the robots beat me. I did not make it out of the first round. Neither did 75% of my other human competitors. But a single brave human made it to the final round against the AI. And I'm happy to report to all of our human listeners that we won. So that's good. Yeah, we're not obsolete yet. In fact, when the results were announced, the entire bar started chanting, humans, humans, humans. So there you go. Massive shout out to the winner, who I'm so sorry. Your name is on the tip of my tongue right now, and I'm sure it'll come to me as soon as I'm done recording the show. But I met you. You're great. Keep on rocking in a free world. Thank you to Rob and Greg and Ariana and Ray and everybody else that was in Asia and everybody else was a part of that night. It was super fun. If you're in the general Raleigh area, check out Annie Betty's Gin and Absinthe House. And ask if they still have any robo-designed cocktails on the menu. They might.
Yeah, I think, I'm glad to hear that the humans won, but it seems like it was a slim margin. So I'm curious to see what happens next year as the AI gets smarter and, you know, learns even more, has a year more of arsenal behind it. But I think that there's one arena where, you know, robots will hopefully never win, and that's in, you know, literal physical taste and flavor. And I think that maybe drives us towards our guest today, right?
Absolutely, it does. So joining us in the studio today, I'm really, really excited to welcome whiskey blender Ebony Major. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're down in Alabama right now, right?
Yes, I moved back to Birmingham, Alabama in 2020.
And that's your hometown. That's where you're from. I lived in Birmingham for a short time. I grew up not far away, a town you've probably heard of, Panama City Beach, Florida, not a town I'm proud of. I left there pretty hastily when I was 17, just after high school ended, and I was driving north to live in Chicago, and my van broke down in Birmingham, Alabama, so I lived there for 6 months.
Were you in the van the entire 6 months?
No, I got an apartment and everything. I was in the Highlands area.
The Highlands, yeah.
The Western supermarket there.
Oh, yeah. They just shut that down maybe 2-3 years ago. And they're, of course, putting apartments.
Yeah. And then I got my van fixed and I kept on cruising up to Chicago. But I loved it there. And I still have a bunch of friends there and I visit back as often as I can. Glad to have you on from Birmingham. It sends me back to my youth. I was 17 years old living in Birmingham. But let's talk about you. What got you into whiskey? Because I don't think you have the straightest trail on how you got to where you are today. No, I don't think any of us do, but let's hear some about yours.
Yeah, so what got me to whiskey? Chance. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, and I, after leaving high school, went to study food science and chemistry. I love all things food, ingredients, consumers, consumer acceptability. It kind of just is what makes me go. So I got my BS in food science and chemistry. And shortly after that, gonna admit it now, my GPA was not good enough. So I was like, I'm just going to stay and do grad school. I had, you know, probably the same college experience as everybody else has sometimes where, you know, you're failing classes or whatever. So I felt like grad school was my fresh start. I had completed a semester with a 4.0. But I was like, do I really want to be in school or do I want to figure out? Because when you're in school as a food scientist, a lot of us stay in research and just really focus on health and nutrition, but I wanted to see what corporate world, as we call it, as a food scientist is like. So I went out to Oregon to work for Diamond Foods at the time. So at the time they own Emerald, Snack Nuts, Pop Secret Popcorn, Kettle Chips. So I was in Oregon doing a summer internship in food safety and quality. And wanted to get closer to home to my grandmother. I know in the industry and even at my time at Diageo, a lot of the push was like, oh, you're supposed to wanted to be in whiskey your whole life. I have not wanted to be in whiskey my whole life. I do not want to be in whiskey my whole life. I'll say that now. So, no, I literally wanted to be closer to home. And I was on Indeed.com and I found this blending internship. And I was like, holy crap, this sounds fun. This sounds interesting. Did all the research into the company. And that led me to Louisville, Kentucky, which is only a 5-hour drive from Birmingham. So I started, I was actually, after that internship in Oregon, I was supposed to go back and finish my degree, which I did not do, but I am doing right now. It's funny how things come back full circle.
Sure.
But so I went to Kentucky on a 1-year contract. So 1-year blending internship. They had just sent down Andrew Mackay from Crown and Montreal, Canada to the U.S. Bullet was about to start building their own distillery. So I came in at the perfect time if you really wanted to know distillation, blending and everything. And I kind of just stayed in it from there. So that's how I got started. Now I'm trying to figure out the exit strategy. But yeah.
I mean, are you a whiskey enthusiast in your free time or is this just, it's all about the business? And I can completely understand if that's the truth. You know, I talk about with pretty candidly how I feel like I'm good at my job. I feel like my job pays my bills, but I don't love it, right? I love sailing. But if I had to go sailing every day to pay my bills, I probably wouldn't love sailing, right?
Now, I'll be honest, you know, my experience as a Black woman has made me not enjoy my job. And I will just be completely candid, even as a consultant, having to negotiate rates or lower rates that I know I shouldn't compared to other you know, a consultant. So I think my specific experience as a Black woman has made me not enjoy it as much because, for being honest, this industry is not ready to be honest about what it's like to be a, I mean, yes, we've given women a platform, but we really have ignored African Americans in this industry. So I think if I had just a swell or fair experience across the board, I might feel a little different about it. But I love the community. I love, you know, when I was in blending and didn't really enjoy the job at Diageo, or the actual distillery, that's what made me say, hey, I'll go to California and talk to bartenders. I'll go to New York and talk to bartenders. For me, it was get me out of like the closed-minded space and get me to the actual consumers. So I think it's the consumers and the community around whiskey that really drive me to stay in it, because whether I'm consuming or not, I'm going to go to a bar and pop up and do my emails or do my homework because of the community around it and the flavor components. I think as a food scientist, I'll always love flavor composition and whiskey in general. It's just taxing to work in this industry. I'll just say that it's very taxing.
Well, sure. I mean, we've talked about this numerous times on the show, how first being a woman, specifically strangely in whiskey, right? Like, I don't think women have as difficult a time in tequila or gin, let's say, but for some reason, whiskey is a stodgy old man situation. And then, yeah, definitely being Black, I'm sure has a second level hurdles. You know, and we know you had some difficulties with exiting Diageo that weren't pretty. Do you think that your experience will help move the needle at all? Do you feel at least some sense of like it's been a trial and a tribulation, but at least maybe the needle's going to move a bit?
You know, I try to remain positive in thinking that. It's unfortunate that, you know, it's 2024 in Diageo and I still have not settled my case. You know, they're upset about an amount of money that they felt was fair that I still don't feel was fair because I was doing a lot of work and not making the fair amount. They are not happy that I told my story at the New York Times. So part of me wants to say, it hasn't moved a needle, but I've also gotten feedback that, because I don't know, honestly, I can speak today, it's February 9th. I don't know how this case is going to end. The legal system, just Diageo and money, like, I just don't know how it's going to end. I've told my lawyer plenty of times, I still feel like I can walk away with nothing. And I'm, the reason I turned my, what I was offered down and to be able to tell this story is to be able to try to move that needle. I'm from Birmingham, and I think growing up in such a civil rights area just really ingrained in me, taught me to think about people other than myself. So I say that to say, my lawyer sat at the U.S. Open one day and sat next to an ex-Diageo person that wanted to share with me that me making that step and making that brave. It was a lot of scary, crying, worried nights that it changed how they did some things internally. There were some internal interviews about, you know, the, I guess, the culture. People were heard. So whether they want to publicly admit, because none of what I'm bringing up in my case is like being disputed. Right. All of it happened. Everything is factual. So I'm disappointed and upset. I'm not going to lie, and upset that they haven't settled my case as swiftly as they've been able to move on other things. And knowing that as a Black woman, even this speaking with you guys, because I've turned down tons of articles, like Bloomberg was about to fly to speak with me. But the fear that I get about speaking my truth and how that might impact my case, I'm beyond that. I've since last month had a therapy session that I'm like, I'm beyond that. She's like, you got to say what you got to say. But I hope it has changed. I will say it hasn't brought positive change for myself, but at the end of the night, I'm hoping it has. And I've received a lot of messages on LinkedIn from people who work either there or at other big name companies, sharing how much they appreciate me being willing to do that article. So that's what helps me sleep at night, despite still fighting this legal case, is that by me doing what I shouldn't be doing. But yeah, that has brought some change for other people, or other people feel more seen or more comfortable stating some things.
I have to assume that, you know, maybe it's not making as visible or quickly visible an impact higher up. You mentioned earlier the community that is the bar world. You know, I think we're all kind of in your corner. And if, at that point, it sort of starts to become a numbers game. You know, you've got more people that are in your corner than aren't. Things will hopefully continue to change and improve for women and Black people in our community. And, we continue to build those longer tables and invite people to sit at them. So, I'm happy that you're out there and that you're making some noise. But let's get back to whiskey. So what are you up to these days? What does life look like for, a blender?
Yeah. What am I up to nowadays? So I earlier talked to you about school. So I ironically was invited to be the keynote speaker for a freshman convocation this past August. And Alabama A&M was like, hey, you should come back and finish that degree. So right now I am a delusional blender / graduate student. Learning all the things about flavors and pigments. So it has been a balancing act. I'm not taking on as much like tasting or project work that I want to, but I'm able to focus on this one growing brand that I'm excited about and able to work with them, because I'm able to just focus on the liquid. It's Fortune's Fool. It's a new brand out of Indiana. It's distributed online right now. So direct to consumer, because as we know, like direct to consumer is kind of the gateway to new consumers right now. Sure. To be able to leverage the new social media platform. So they're available there. But this couple has been buying distillate. So they are not buying source liquid. They are buying distillate that they kind of figured out their own mash bill. So in October, we released a 62% rye. I'm at about 32 months. This new one will be a full 3 years. So with this team, I work through analyzing their barrels, kind of creating an innovation pipeline. And when I say that, it's really identifying what barrels are good to use now, tracking and understanding the changes in the barrels. I mean, this time around when I did sensory, I saw a lot of creamy notes that I didn't see 6 to 9 months. So 6 to 9 months ago in these same samples. So it's really about like just the ongoing sensory, tracking the liquid, understanding the brand's growth plan, you know, how fast they want to accelerate, what that means for liquid, how we release the liquid. And right now I'm working on batch number 2. So I think this one was the prelude, and the next one, is it the overture? What is the next? It's after Romeo and Juliet. So, it's their cute story. But yeah, that's what I'm working on. So, but my typical day is like the last month and a half, because I'm in deep blend delivery, is just sensory. So pouring samples, I don't look at a lot of samples per day like I used to. So I might do 15 to 20 max. I'm taking notes. I might look at a sample 2 to 3 times each just to make sure the notes are right. And then I go through and I'm grouping them and doing all my Excel calculations to see, you know, which of the 60 I want to combine. We're up to formulas 7 right now. So I've presented 7 formulas so far. We still have not chosen one. So I just go back to the drawing board and try a different combination of barrels, because which I love what I do, which will probably keep me in it, is because it's so, it's a myth still. People don't really understand what blending is, what I do, but it's fun to present seven formulas to a client and they don't know how I got there, but they know that there's a difference between one and two, two and seven, five and six. So that's what I do. Yeah.
How, I mean, whiskey is such a long game because it has to rest and age. How does one acquire these skills at such a young age as yourself to be able to, you know, examine these things and then forecast it? You know, you're talking about what changed in the creaminess that appeared over a 9-month period, but how do you know then to forecast what's going to happen next? Like, where do you acquire those skills?
So how I learned blending was a lot of sampling. I was eager when I was there. And I also, what I loved, what I really loved about working for Diageo is that there were so many distilleries. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I were maybe with another company, we might have had one, let's just say Beam, we had that one distillery. But when I was working with Diageo, I was working on Dickel, so I got to see Tennessee whiskey. I got to work with MGP for our Bullet Rye. I got to work with whatever contract parties we worked with in Kentucky, as well as starting up Shelbyville. So over the course of my career, I was able to understand the difference in a farmer's grain, the difference in a yeast strain, a difference in dry versus liquid yeast. I got to see the difference in the distillery character. So each distillery has its own character. And I got to see everything they had in their inventory. I got to see old, we'll call it old Four Roses stuff, old whatever. I got to see a lot of different. I don't say that to call them out. I say that for people to really understand that I was able to see young, so distillate and maturate from different distilleries over a 5-year period. And I really think that the combination and the encyclopedia that I've created in my head of knowing, okay, this is what a 21% rye at this distillery with this mash bill would typically look like. This is what a 36 would look like. This is what a 95 would look like. This is what a 51. So really understanding that and creating kind of your own mental library of what to look for. Part of my fun job while I was there, I loved being a scientist, being there and trying to create that connection. Okay. Because as a blender, earlier, I think we talked a little bit about like distilling versus blending, and I love that conversation because it's the great debate.
We're going to get back to it.
And of course, I have my reasons for thinking that blending is like, I won't say is we touch liquid from beginning to end. We're the only ones, you know, the distiller, once it's in the barrel, they're kind of just, you know, done with it. But there's a lot of work that's put into, as a blender, you're smelling distillate before it goes in the barrel. So one of my projects was trying to see, okay, if it's a distillate quality 4 or distillate quality 3, what is that more than likely to become in 4 years? There's not a linear, like there's not a 1-to-1 because you have difference in barrels. So also at my time there, I was able to see barrels being sourced from different cooperages, which brings on a completely different, it's a whole nother fun thing. But there's just, I'm sorry, I can go down a rabbit hole, but yeah,
no,
there's differences.
I love it too. And it just seems that you were exposed to such a massive catalog. You were just in the right place at the right time to have
exactly
so much at your fingertips. And you have obviously a pretty exploratory nature, and you just, you dove in. And it's obviously paying off for you. You're excelling in this field, which is, I think Greg wanted to talk about what you just brought up, sort of single barrel and just distillate versus blending.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've really watched this whole field. By the way, I just have to ask, you stopped yourself when you were saying the difference between blending and distilling. And you were about to say, like, blending is, was the word on the tip of your tongue better? Because you could say it. We love hot takes on the Speakeasy. It's fine. You can come out and be honest about that.
Blending is superior because I've literally had distillers kind of take this, once it's in the barrel, it is what it is attitude, you know, like I've done my job. And yes, you have done your job, but the barrel is also going to come in and do its job. And we don't know.
The weather will do its job.
Exactly.
Like there's so many things, right?
So this concept of going straight from barrel to bottle might sound great to consumers, but I've seen a lot of bad barrels, and I just would hate for a bad barrel to slip in not only a blend. I've seen a blend, you put in a specific barrel, maybe you change the percentage 5%, it'll change how your entire liquid tastes, because that one slightly earthy barrel, and earthy is a note that we look for, if it's soil, if it's, you know, like fresh ground earth or basement, immediate reject, because that's something that's not going to age out in wood. That's why we're looking at liquid from a distillate level. We're also looking to see if the distillate is just grainy. Grain and wood are probably just going to give me grain and wood at the end of the day. So when we're looking for distillate, we're looking for fruit, we're looking for cleanliness, we're looking for all the things that are telling us that this is going to turn into some potentially great maturate 3 to 4 years down the line. So the distiller does a really great job. We could not have great whiskey without the distiller. I just think that we don't give the blenders that are holding hands with the distiller as they distill, because that was what our kind of role is not just here's the liquid. We're helping create the maturation plans. We're helping create the mash bills, you know, figuring out the sourcing. When you're looking at blending, so here's an example as to why blenders and distillers hold hands. When you're a blender and you want to create a product 4 years down the line, you don't want your distiller to make all your rye January to June and then come make your bourbon July to December. You know why? It's because it's a very seasonal thing. You want to be able to split that rye and that bourbon between those 6 months in January and June, so maybe 3 months here, 3 months there, and do that throughout the year. That doesn't really happen if you're not working hand in hand with your blender, which is the person that's forecasting and planning and figuring out and reserving barrels for different products in the future. So yeah, that's my take.
Hearst Ranch, in collaboration with Whole Foods Market, is proud to be the presenting sponsor of the Farm Report, a special HRN series in collaboration with the National Young Farmers Coalition. Tune in each week to hear from farmers, policymakers, organizers, and food advocates about all the ways the Farm Bill directly impacts our lives, whether we realize it or not. They'll break down farm policy and talk to young farmers about what hangs in the balance for them as another Farm Bill gets made. Join the coalition to shift power and change policy for the next generation of growers and land stewards. The future of good food depends on it. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The world is changing faster than ever, and you need a website to go with it. Whether you're a seasoned pro looking to build your following or just starting out with a brand new idea, you need a landing page that's bold, innovative, and uniquely yours.
Whatever your passion, you need a web designer with experience, panache, and heart. We can't help you with any of that. Hi, I'm Lou Bank.
And I'm Greg Benson. Are we Silicon Valley tech visionaries? No, we're podcast hosts, and that's basically the same thing. And we're here to tell you about Ancestral Agave Syrup.
Ancestral Agave Syrup is the 100% pure nectar of the agave plant. Now, wait a minute, you're thinking. I've had 100% pure agave nectar. Well, not like this, you haven't.
That stuff is processed with a diffuser, which introduces acid. Plus, it comes from Blue Weber, a monoculture that dominates farms, depletes the soil, and won't help you grow your brand or expand your e-commerce functionality.
Ancestral agave syrup, on the other hand, is made by slowly cooking down the pure agua miel from Salmiana agaves in Hidalgo and Tlaxcala, two states that have been harvesting those plants for generations. It also won't expand your e-commerce functionality, but it will grow your brand if your brand is person who makes kick-ass margaritas or pecan pies or pancakes.
Unfortunately, the families behind this tasty stuff are being offered big beer company bucks to rip out their agave and plant barley instead. which would be a crime because Ancestral Agave Syrup is about as far from the processed stuff as 100% pure Vermont maple syrup is from that sticky bottle at a diner.
So, don't build a homepage from one of several easy-to-use templates, but do grab Ancestral Agave Syrup today. Our first 25 customers will also receive a special limited edition agave superhero comic book. So do not wait. Protect the land, make better drinks, and save the bats by grabbing some today.
Wait, what was that about bats?
Yeah, it's an important food source on the migration path of the Mexican long-nosed bat.
Huh.
Yeah, the flowering stalks of the agave also provide protection from predators.
Oh, well, that's cool. Should we get back to the ad now?
Yeah, let's do that. Go to ancestralagave.com or click the link in the show notes to grab some today.
Ancestral Agave Syrup. It won't help you build a beautiful website, but it will make your cocktails taste really, really good.
I would love to talk a little bit about how the sort of public consciousness of what you do and of the massive impact and the technical skill and the nuance and like the skill set that you have to develop. I'd love to talk a little bit about how sort of the public perception of that has evolved over the last 10 years, because, you know, in the 2010s, we saw this massive explosion of small batch distilleries in the United States. I mean, it was nuts. Like there were a lot of like macroeconomic forces that contributed to that. Like interest rates were really low. Free money was everywhere. People liked investing in like whiskey distilleries were cool. But, you know, you would go to these places that would be a year old and they would be like, here's our 3-year whiskey. And you'd be sitting there like, this doesn't add up. And there were people that were, there was a spectrum of how honest places were willing to be about this. I was saying earlier, I have a lot of respect for High West because they were always very open about the fact that like, this is a blend and we really feel that like the craft of doing this put us in a place where we can say we made this whiskey. And I agree with them. And then there were other places that may or may not have been making a recipe that was developed by Al Capone that got sued because they were so misleading about the way their whiskey was made and where it came from. But I want to sort of ask how you feel your work has been perceived. And also if you feel like there's still, because the thing that bothers me about that, knowing more about whiskey blending, is that there was this effort by a lot of places to hide that art. And when it is so much a part of making whiskeys that have been around for, you know, centuries, like Scotch whiskey makers blend that shit. You know, how do you feel about the way that your work is perceived and talked about in the overall community?
I think a lot of it is driven from marketing. So, you know, while I was in my role, I wanted to get more into marketing to be able to tell the true narrative. Like they would want to send me out on events and send me like potential talking notes or decks. And I'm like, yeah, no, this is how you can say it. This is how you can make it real. No, we're not sourcing. We are working with like, I think a lot of it took me getting out and talking about what third-party contract. We really started to really unravel what that was. No, we're not, just because there are current brands. And as a consultant, I am usually trying to pitch my services. There are still people who are willing to buy liquid and just blend. You can't see me, but I'm air quoting and blend.
We can hear the air quotes. It's okay.
But they just buy barrels and call it blending themselves instead of actually. And I think that is extremely, I won't say dangerous for your brand, but buying liquid on an open market and not having a professional taste the barrels individually to get a true understanding of what you're buying and you're potentially bottling, I think is not a good place to be for a consumer, because the consumer is looking for consistency. They're looking to know that what they buy today is going to taste the same if they come back in 6 months, 9, a year.
Yeah, it just seems short-sighted. It seems like a cash grab in those situations where people are just buying a free market liquid and slapping a label on it and sending it out to the consumer as a new to the market product that you know sure, you've got a chance that it's going to be, frankly, maybe there's a chance it's going to be outstanding, but it seems like more chances that it's going to be just okay, and kind of even more chances it's going to be mediocre or less, right?
Yeah, so my question is always to these brands, why should they buy it?
Right.
Why should a consumer buy it? Because you put a cool label and a cool story? You have to give them more. In my personal opinion, you have to give them more. You have to... I'm not going to buy something. I mean, I might. The girl in me might just see it. Ooh, it's the pretty label. Let me buy this.
I mean, marketing is a hell of a drug, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it gets people to do and purchase goofy things. I just think that, I hope anyway, that even listening to you talk, our audience is hearing that, you know, I don't want to put down anybody, but like, it seems to me that the distiller, certainly, obviously an important part of this puzzle, but it kind of has the lower lift job. Just needs to make sure that the grains are of good quality, needs to make sure that the yeast is pitched at the right time, et cetera, and make the liquid. The harder job is the blending. It's almost like I don't know, I can take a photograph and cut it into a bunch of pieces and then tear it apart. That I've made a puzzle. That's great. Now you have to put the puzzle together. Right. So that's a little bit harder.
I one, don't want to get canceled because there's so many. So many.
You don't have a job if there's not a distiller. I feel like, you know, there's, you know, plenty of craft involved in the distiller.
Yeah. I think for a while we've wanted the distiller to be like the head, the face of the brand, the person that is just seen as that
guitarist. Yeah. Like, right out front, you know?
And we get that. I think it's equally important to really discuss the people who have a hand in that end product. Unless you're telling me that you're a distiller, and which is also something that I've seen that is extremely dangerous. Yeah. Why do I keep using the word dangerous? People using the word distiller and blender interchangeably. There's some people who call themselves distiller / blender. Kind of a conflict of interest, because I've pissed some distillers off before by telling them that their liquid that they might think is a quality 4 is actually like a quality 2, in my opinion. So it's kind of hard to be able to be in both positions as the distiller and the blender, because you're really giving them feedback. Like I said, you're holding hands.
That's gotta be valuable information for them, right? To hear you say, look, you thought you had this level of quality. I'm telling you, you don't. And I'm sort of the expert in this part of the arena. But here's how I can help you, right?
Yeah.
It comes with a, there's more to the story. The story isn't over here, but here's how we can help fix it. We can use these barrels and blend them. And, you know, like that's where the real challenge seems to raise its head up.
Seems like the problem is that there might be some fragile egos out there.
Oh, do we not bring up the fragile egos? Yeah, they're out there.
I can just see this going so wrong.
Yes, you forget the fragile ego.
Because I love distillers, I really do. It's just like, I think the marketing guys have just made it like they created it what they want it to be. And exactly. It's not like a distiller versus blender. It's like these are the makers of our liquid. Like these are the makers in total of our liquid.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's as with everything, it's not just marketing, but I think everything, we try and romanticize everything, right? We try and make these grand illusions. And, you know, it's very romantic to think that like there's one person who's like got their finger on the button and they're, you know, they're producing this product sort of single-handedly, and they tromp around the country and the world, you know, talking about it, which means that they're not back at the button.
Actually right? Doing the, I always say that, oh, this is another thing that's going to get me canceled. all these blenders or people, distillers that you see on these constant tours are not blending if they're on constant marketing tours.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there's work to be done.
Somebody's got to be back at the helm of the ship.
Well, especially too, because that seems like such an individualized thing. I mean, like I say, a lot of times, like I always tell this every time I'm teaching a class, when I ask people like what they think of something that we've just made, I'm like, I'm only going to be serious one time in this class. And that's now, when I say that there literally is no wrong answer when I ask people what they think of something. Like, I think our job is interesting because taste is subjective, and one person's yuck might be somebody else's yum. I think that's what makes this world of food and drinks not boring. But also that means that, you know, there's not it's not like you can give someone a spreadsheet and be like, all right, I'm going on vacation, you take over this. Like, they're going to make different stuff than you are, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, blending is a spreadsheet. I will say that, but they are going to make different things.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't want to get canceled by the spreadsheet community. I love a good spreadsheet, but like.
That's one thing I had no idea I was getting myself into. I don't like math. Blending is all math. Like, you're literally starting out with my barrel has how many LPAs? Okay. It's how old? Okay. That means I've lost what percent angel share per year? Okay, that means I have how much left? It's literally all math. And then right. It's a little bit of taste. it's so fun. I think that's what keeps me in it too. It's like, it's really challenging. It's like, how do I do this? I blow my mind somehow. It's like, because I get to this Excel sheet every time and I'm like, where do we start? How do we do this? Because it's just so many, like, just knowing the calculations or, you know, how many bottles are in a case and what, how many LPAs you'll get per case based on your final proof. It's just magical. It's fun, okay. Though. I like to zone out and do it with music.
That's really freaking, because I did not know that. I'd never heard that about the active blending. And that almost seems like you're hacking the matrix, basically. It's like you figured out these formulas that will tell you, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of variables in here, but if you can control for them, you can basically predict this is what this is going to taste like in a year, 2 years, 5 years. And that's,
yeah,
wild.
That's what my job was. And that's what I say, like, you're working, that's why you're working hand in hand with the distiller, because as you created a blend. So let's say one of the things I was working on was Harper. I have the archive formulas, you know, I would know what those components were year after year. And that's the fun part. You might open a sheet and think you can just plug in a year for year. Oh, it was 2000. We used fiscal 2009 last year. We're just going to use fiscal 2010 this year. Those tastes might be completely different. So instead of going 2009, 2010, you might be jumping 2011. And because that 2011 might be young, you might need to go in and put a little bit of 2008 to balance those flavors out. But how is that going to impact your cost? Because the barrel costs of 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011 all have different barrel costs because they were all made in a different year. So when I'm still presenting that formula to the brand, not only does it have to taste right, it has to be about the same cost as it was. So it's a lot of like cracking the code. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Sorry.
That is nuts. And that also, I mean, that very much appeals to like the OCD part of my brain. But man, not that me. Is like, yeah, I don't think I could do that job.
That is beyond anything I want to deal with. I want to be the guy at the end of the trail who gets to taste it and say, this is delicious. I don't want to have to look at any of those spreadsheets and stuff. Speaking of delicious, though, you had a hand in the production and blending of the George Dickel Bottled and Bond in 2019, which was the number one whiskey of the year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's quite an accolade. And we know Nicole Austin over there. Was she there when you were there?
She was. You know, it was she came in. I can't remember what year she came in, but when she came in as distiller general manager, she had some innovation plans for Dickel. And again, part of my job was if you want to innovate and create new products, we have to make sure that that's not impacting Dickel 8, Dickel 12, Dickel single barrel select. So
your regular consumers who've been drinking that juice for, you know, literally decades, so that you can't come in and innovate them out of the circle, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's a lot of taboo about the blending of Dickel, but how this kind of occurred was Nicole came in, wanted to innovate and let us know she wanted to create a bottle and a bond. So from there, I went in and had to go through the inventory, go through those old archives, go through those spreadsheets. Not only did I have to look at like what the current formula was using, but maybe 2-3 years out to see, mm-hmm. to make sure we weren't going to be impacted by anything. Once I had narrowed down, here are the lots you can use. She went through, chose out some lots, presented some things that were good, but we had to do a bit of reworking. So there were some barrels, one in particular, it was like 2G, which is grainy. So really just reworking that formula to make sure that, hey, we might not want to put a 2G out on the market. So that's kind of how we worked hand in hand, is I am kind of the guardian of the inventory with Dickel, submit the formula, and then at the end of the day, the blending team is the one that's kind of creating the formula, putting it in the system, and telling the distillers, not the distillers, the warehouse team, what to pull from. But that was a fun project. I mean, Bottled and Bond is cool. Bottled and Bond is a one season, one distiller. You know, Bottled and Bond is what I was talking about earlier, why you want to work hand in hand with your distillers, especially if you need multiple mash bills. Dickel is a pretty easy product because they only create one mash bill versus like our Bullet Bourbon, we were creating 10. Sure. So it was pretty easy where you don't make an impact. But if you're working with a brand where you want to make multiple mash bills, doing a Bottled and Bond might be a little bit harder, or you just look at your inventory a little bit different. But a Bottled and Bond, while it's an innovation, it's simply just same season, same distiller at certain ABV. So that one mash bill, yeah.
I mean, and it's incredible juice. I'm a longtime fan of Dickel. I think that was one of the first whiskeys I drank as a young man.
You know what's interesting about my job is like I have to put my preference aside, and mm-hmm. Dickel was one of the hardest things for me to blend because I didn't like the flavor.
Fascinating to bring up. I hadn't even considered that. You do have to set your preferences aside when you're in that position. You know, I sit on the judging panel for LA Spirits and for New Orleans Spirits competitions. And yeah, like there's a part of the tasting panel where you're just grading it on quality, not whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm. So when I first got my assignment, I think like I took a blend my first 9 months there because it was Andrew, he was handling the whole US portfolio. So while publicly I did a lot of like work on Bullet, we were doing all US whiskey. So the Dickels, the Harpers, Bullet. So we were working on that. I forgot what we were talking about that quick. What were we talking
just
about?
Just having to set aside your preference.
Yes. So when I got Dickel, I was like, ooh, this is weird. And Dickel has a certain character. And mm-hmm. Andrew was like, Ebony, you cannot change that. That's what they're looking for.
Right.
So it was like, okay, Ebony, you need to learn to like Flintstone vitamins. Because that's the flavor that I had to blend for. Mm-hmm. I would present the first two vitamins. I thought I knew what I was doing. I think he's like, yeah, no, it's not vitamin enough. It's not vitamin enough. It's not what is literally not what we're looking for. And that was my, okay, each liquid has a profile. It has a standard. And that is what you're blending to. It's not your personal preference, which made me kind of a rebel, which made me creating or being the one responsible for finding the barrels and creating the Bullet single barrel program was extremely fun because it was completely opposite of what I had to do. It wasn't creating the liquid to stay the same. It was, everybody knows that we're kind of a source brand. How do we offer them a unique single barrel experience? How do we pull apart these 10 pieces and offer single barrels? So that was completely different. And then when I created Bullet Blender Select, that was completely different. It was literally me. I had, so we have an inventory code and you kind of know, there's about 50 different codes. And you know a code if it's kind of used. And this one was 3X. And 3X isn't like a commonly used code because it's slightly different. It's flavorful. And so my mind had gone through, so every year you start a blend by going through all the samples, the lineup. Even if it says 3X and you don't think you're going to use it, you still got to smell it to see. And I had seen these barrels get passed up year after year. Like, okay, it might not fit this, but it can fit something. And that's what made me come up with Blender Select. It was, hey, these pieces, like I told you earlier, whenever you want to innovate, you got to make sure it's not pulling out of your future plans. So that was me going through the inventory of some 9, some 13-year-old bourbons that I found and creating something that did not have to match anything on the market. And that was extremely fun.
That is amazing. And I have to say, I haven't thought about Flintstones vitamins in about 30 years, but you're right. It's an extremely, I can picture it on my tongue now. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly distinct taste, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to have pickle rye again without thinking about that.
Okay, the rye might not have it as much.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. But yeah, but no,
it has
also,
a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, but no, I know exactly the flavor you're talking about. I was like, oh my, it totally, it totally tracks. Oh man. So I'd love to ask what's next for you, and if people wanted to follow along with your exploits, where'd be a good spot for them to do that?
Yeah, I don't ever know what's next. I kind of just like go where the whiskey takes me. Right now, I'm really enjoying.
That's been problematic for me a few times.
Look, it might be. I'm finishing this degree. I'm going to finish this master's. I'm focusing on beverage formulation because I think my next pivot that I want to make is going to be in cannabis. I think I'm interested in some beverage formulation there. So I'm going to finish that up this summer while still doing my blending. I told you I have a very important meeting to go to. And so I'm working on this kind of like secret brick and mortar idea as well. So,
ooh, okay.
I'm taking my time. I don't put time limits on myself because I like to do things very organically. But over the past couple of years, I've gone back and forth with the brand if I wanted to do my own thing. And I want to do something, but I think a physical space is really a physical space to bring people together is really what I'm interested in. So I am working on that. You can always keep up. I don't post hardly ever, but you can always keep up with me on Instagram at Major in Whiskey. But yeah, I am planning to stay in this industry kind of in a way that feels good and looks like me. I'll just say that. All right. Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing what comes next for you. And I know you've got a meeting to get to, and we're running close on time, so we're going to cut it off. But we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about some fun stuff and a little bit of hard stuff as well. That's always welcome here on the show. Thanks for enlightening us to what goes on in the blending world, which I think is often overlooked, where that rock star distiller gets the front page all the time. That's it for this episode of The Speakeasy. Thanks for tuning in. To check out heritageradionetwork.org for plenty more shows just like this one. There's a beating heart on the website somewhere where you can donate to keep us on the air. Really had a great time talking to you, Ebony, all the way from Birmingham, Alabama. Cheers, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you don't shun the devil with your rock. The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.